Okay, so we ran over last time and decided to have a third talk and give me a little bit more time to go over some of these things. So just to review, there is a set of ideas I've been pursuing over the number of years having to do with anomalies, both chiral anomaly, axial anomaly in gauge theories, and also the conformal anomaly in gravity. And today, so we've covered most of this in the last two talks, and the main point is that the conformal part of the metric becomes dynamical due to this scalar mode associated with the effective action of the anomaly. And today, in the last part, I'm going to talk about possible applications of this to a number of different issues. Black holes, if you came to my talk a few weeks ago, I was talking about possible effects on the horizons of black holes, and this conformal anomaly effective theory actually gives a microscopic or more microscopic background and justification for that. And interestingly, because the conformal part of the metric becomes dynamical, there are new propagating modes in the low energy theory, which are scalars, and we'll talk about that and how this can actually do some very interesting things in cosmology. So I think I'm going to skip. This is just repeating what was said the last couple of weeks of what an effective field theory is and why one should add, I would say, the marginally relevant term of the conformal anomaly effective action, which is non-local in terms of the original curvature tensors and metric variables, but can be made local. So because it's non-local in those variables, it's quite different than most of the modifications that are considered for semi-classical or quantum effects in gravity. And it can have long-distance effects. But it can be made local by the introducing at least one new scalar field. And this leads to sensitivity in the IR, or more properly on the light cone, to ultraviolet degrees of freedom through the anomaly matching conditions, if you wish. And this is relevant on horizons. So the essential steps we went through last time was to construct this effective action. I won't go through the algebra again, but it's fairly straightforward. You asked me to put the slides up, so the slides will be, I'll send you the slides. So this is the general form of the anomaly. This is the Weyl tensor squared. This is the Euler-Gauss-Bonnet term. So it's local in the stress tensor trace, but you cannot write a local action in terms of the curvature invariants themselves, which is why it's an anomaly. You can't just renormalize it away by a local counter term. And because of this, the non-local form, it introduces massless poles, which are these additional degrees of freedom. So here's the non-local form in its glory. It has this Euler-Gauss-Bonnet invariant, and I combined it with a certain combination of Box-R because this is a linear function of the conformal part of the metric, and this is the analog of the Polyakov action in 2D. So in 2D, this is some coefficient, the central charge times the Ricci scalar, and the action in 2D looks like this. And in 4D, we have a more complicated anomaly structure, and we get a more complicated expression but this is the exact analog of it. Delta 4 is the analog of 1 over the wave operator, the Green's function of the wave operator in 2D. And the total anomaly can have all these terms in it. It can have curvature invariants, it can have gauge fields, and for example, also the gluon field of QCD. So we'll talk about how that might be relevant to observational tests. So I can make this non-local form local by introducing at least one field. You could introduce more, but let's keep it simpler. And the minimal modification I can make the minimal addition I can make of a violin variant term to make this whole thing a perfect square, basically. You see, it's asymmetric. I have this invariant on the left side, and I have this sum of invariants on the right side. So if I tried to reproduce this action exactly, I would have to introduce two fields. But if I complete the square, so to speak, by adding the relevant term on this side, which is equivalent because it's violin variant, so it's also a perfectly good action which generates the anomaly, then I introduce only one field, and that field is called phi, or I call it a conformalon field to distinguish it from a dilaton, because it is not, because of its couplings, it's quite different than dilatonic models of gravity. So this is the form. It's a free theory in the phi field. It's quadratic with a linear coupling to the anomaly, and that is very much akin to what happens in 2D. These coefficients are given by just a number of central terms, if you wish, the scale number of scalars, fermions, and vector fields. And delta 4 phi satisfies this equation. It's sourced by the anomaly. If I were to formally solve this by introducing the Green's function for this operator, I would get back to this plus violin invariant terms.
Question.
Yeah.
Is this really hyperderivative, or are you saying that's a solution?
Is it really what?
Is it a really hyperderivative
thing,
or are you?
Well, it's a higher. This is delta four. I'm going to write it down. We're going to analyze it. I'm going to show you. Yes. Right now, it's definitely a fourth derivative term.
Okay. There's no question. I haven't been sure when to ask it about whether you can say anything in justification of this formulas.
Well, this is just derived from the form of the anomaly.
Well, not at all. Okay, so you derive. If this is too long, tell me that it's
Yeah. You're worried about the fourth order difference.
Well, okay. So the basic concern is if you're getting expectation value, you should take it on the left hand side as well as the right hand side. If you decide to ignore that, you get something which I would say has been known for quite a long time can give you nonsensical results.
There's no instability of flat space. There's no instability of flat space. Been analyzed.
There's long-standing result.
The long-standing result is for local terms with R squared and bio squared local term. This is a non-local action. It's completely different. But let's go through it. Let's.
Okay.
Can we postpone? Because I'm gonna show you some analysis of this. So it should hopefully gets clearer. Okay. Yes, Neil.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
The change from line one to line two is up to non-local violin variant.
Right. Right.
Can you just comment on those terms? It's a bit of a mystery, but there may be extra.
Well, there will be in general extra terms. There's no doubt that when you analyze conformal field theories, for example, you find additional violin variant terms.
But they're non-local.
They're quite complicated.
Right.
If you look at their structure, you know, they have all kinds of branch cuts, and you know the general loveliness of higher perturbative corrections in field theory.
Right.
But there's no massless poles in there. Okay.
So this is the leading.
This is a term. So I talked about this a little bit last week. This is a term which scales in a way which suggests it could be important. I think it is, technically speaking, marginally relevant.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show a bunch of applications. So you see that, you know, in some looser physical sense, it's relevant in that it actually has effects on long distance physics. I don't think that's true of any of the other terms, but we have no control of those. Those are much more complicated,
right.
And you know, from looking at other examples like QED and QCD, this is the important effect that gives you these additional feeding of ultraviolet to infrared. But you know, I can say a few more words, but it's not a rigorous proof. So
there are reasons to believe this is the most important thing in the eye.
And near horizons, which is what is going to be my point. And this is certainly an additional degree of freedom here in the because if I put it this way, it's a kinetic term.
Why are you saying the horizons as opposed to in the IR? Because in the IR, it's sort of buy it.
Yeah. So IR is a little bit fuzzy term. The point is, you get massless poles, as we discussed last week, and those are light-like singularities. So of course they can have long-distance effects. I mean, we see the light from the distant galaxies because it propagates on the null cone. So it's infrared in that sense, but not in the sense of, you know, space-like separations. It's not infrared in that sense. It's null. It's light-like.
It can also be infrared in the other sense. It's a massless field that can have long.
Okay. In some cases, yes, but I'm thinking of it primarily. So I said IR, but I think we'd have to be careful and look at it case by case. All right. So I gave a heuristic argument last week as to why I think this is the most important term. Now I'm going to show you applications where it actually is. It definitely should be added, I would say. Whether or not you want to argue about the other terms, that's another question. But let's go there.
About the Tris G squared term,
right.
Is it somehow it seems a little bit counterintuitive that it would contribute to a non-local action? It's non-local on scales longer than the, you know, confined
scale.
So is it?
Well, when I look at local sources, this is going to contribute locally only if, you know, if I have short distance fission. I mean, you could talk about neutron star mergers where the gluon condensate is excited. So it's a source. Of course, if there's no source, if you're outside the QCD scale, then that term just goes to zero and you have a source-free equation. So it doesn't contribute in that sense. It just acts as a source only where it's active. Okay? Yeah. Good. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. These coefficients are related to the beta function, so we know they're there just from experiments, from the running of the couplings. Okay. So this is what I said last week, that this is a logarithmic scaling with distance, and should be included in the low energy macroscopic theory. And by the way, this is a non-trivial modification of general relativity, which I would say is highly motivated or required even by quantum effects in the standard model. And it is, in the local form, a scalar tensor theory, but very different, as you see, from the form of the Lagrangian from Brans-Dickey, for example. So now, with that thing in hand, basically, I'm now going to apply it in different circumstances and show you what these effects are so we can bring out the physics. So once you have a coordinate invariant scalar action, you can vary it and get a conserved stress tensor. And what this basically gives you, if nothing else, is a compact way of calculating quantum vacuum polarization effects in terms of a scalar field. So normally, you see, I've already done all the renormalization and regularization and all that stuff which we talked about a few weeks ago or last week. Because I've already written down the effect of action. So everything that you would need to do to renormalize the theory has been done here in just arriving at this finite form for the trace anomaly in terms of finite coefficients. So I don't need to calculate vacuum polarization effects in terms of fundamental fields over and over again. I just need, if I think this is the dominant term, to look at this as a classical theory with phi being a C number. Of course, the coefficients are quantum, they're proportional to H bar, but other than that, this is just a classical action, and I can vary it, calculate a stress tensor, and that should give me information about quantum vacuum polarization effects in terms of the scalar field and the background geometry. Yeah?
This is the renormalized stress tensor. Given a scheme choice corresponding to the
That's right. That's right. So it's not by no means, and this is relevant to your question, it's by no means claimed that this is the exact quantum stress tensor. It is how, I mean, I think this is what Bardeen has been discussing. And so there's no guarantee whatsoever that it's going to give you all the finite terms if you calculated everything, you know, laboriously in the fundamental theory. But it is a part, and it is a significant part, as I'll show you in a moment. So this was the thing I flashed up last week. Okay, it's complicated, but manageable, it turns out. And here's the delta four equation. It's this differential operator, and here's the source of the anomaly term. So you can put it on one slide with a little bit of a little bit of squeezing. So yeah, I guess I should only point out also that there are terms, because the action is both, I won't go back, the action is both linear and quadratic in phi, there are terms quadratic in phi, and there are terms linear in phi. The trace, if I take the trace, I will of course recover the trace anomaly by using the equation of motion from the terms linear in phi, whereas the terms quadratic in phi have zero trace, so they're conformal. That's very similar again to 2D. So now if you go to, let's take the first simplest example. Let's look at what this stress tensor is in flat space. In flat space, it looks like this. And phi satisfies a source-free equation, which is higher derivative, box squared equals zero. And here I can look for static solutions, in particular things which go like second power are annihilated by this fourth order operator. And if I plug this simple function in here, what I actually get is up to a constant, which I haven't determined, depends on boundary conditions, but up to a constant, I get exactly the Casimir stress tensor between parallel plates. So here's sort of, you know, a two-line calculation of the Casimir effect, and you just have to determine the constant by the boundary condition. So that's clearly a macroscopic quantum effect. This is the distance between the plates that's captured by the stress tensor, just almost for free. Okay. Now, the second case that is more interesting, is more dynamical, is to linearize the equations around flat space. So clearly, phi equals zero is the solution in flat space, and this is zero in flat space, so I can linearize this equation around flat space, expand the metric in the usual way. This is a covariant decomposition. These are four indices. And there's a particular linear combination, which is gauge invariant, which is, of course, the HAB part, transverse part, and a certain combination of this trace part and this part I call W. So if you look at the linearized Einstein tensor, the components look like this, okay, in the TT and TI components. And on the right-hand side, I get the linearized stress tensor components, TTT and TI, of this conformal anomaly stress tensor. And look, you see what happens. The fourth derivatives organize themselves in a very special way. This isn't just any fourth order action. So you see I have a Laplacian on box, and here I have a gradient and a time derivative on box phi. So it means I can immediately solve these equations up to constants, which is the gauge invariant scalar mode, is proportional to box phi. Which means if I solve this equation, box squared phi equals zero, I have two sets of modes, and one set just drops out. Box phi, if box phi is zero, that's zero on this side, it's just decoupled. And box squared phi has a second solution, which box phi is this, and that generates a scalar wave. There's no instability around flat space. Yeah.
Since you have fourth order diffusion equation, what about Ostrogradsky?
There's no Ostrogradsky ghost here.
No ghosts.
No, I mean, if I do nonlinearities of the strong fields, then I have to worry about how the other modes come in. But that's nonlinearity is coming purely from the Einstein term. If I linearize around flat space, any possible fourth order terms are just decoupled. And it's very important that you have to use the constraint equations of the Einstein theory, the diffeomorphism constraints. Because if I just write down the action, I have the fourth order terms, but half of them are decoupled by the constraints.
You can't see that the slope yet.
I can't do?
You have to go to quadratic order in general.
Yeah, you have to go to strong fields, but there's no quadratic order. There are no quadratic order in phi. The quadratic, phi is a free theory. So the only quadratic terms you're worried about come from nonlinearities in gravity itself, in the Einstein theory, which means strong fields. And then in strong fields, we don't talk about ghosts, we talk about whether the background is actually dynamically stable or not. Because it's a different issue. It's a different issue.
So when you come to marking black holes?
Yeah, I haven't got the black holes yet. Let me get there. Yeah, let me get there. Okay, but notice how this works. Half the solutions disappear. If I put the anomaly coefficient to zero, I of course recover the Einstein theory where this mode is not propagating at all. It's constrained, right? Because these are space derivatives. So, but what happens is very similar to what we discussed with the Schwinger model and the chiral anomaly flat space example last week, is that because of the constraint equations, there was Gauss' law, here it's the TT and TI components of Einstein's equations, the solutions of this equation, half of them, are generating wave-like solutions for the metric. Okay? That, at linear order, that's all there is to it. Okay? So you can work out in the space plus time split, just to make sure you're not fooling yourself in this covariant analysis. More Hamiltonian analysis is to introduce these Bardeen-like potentials, A, B, C, D, E, and treat space and time separately. Then these are gauge invariant to gauge invariant potentials called epsilon A and C, because I didn't want to use phi, as Bardeen does. And then these are the linearized Einstein equations in this set of variables. And this is the IJ component. And if you solve these equations, you again find that there's a gauge invariant potential, gravitational potential. In this case, the two are equal and proportional to box phi. But of course, if I take another wave operator on this, I get box squared phi on this side, which is zero. So these are wave, non-trivial wave solutions. And notice the potentials obey second order wave equations. Okay, so now let's ask, well, where can this arise? Okay, can I actually see these waves in any astrophysical environment? So just solve for the retarded Green's function, for the phi field, in terms of a source. The source is the whole anomaly. And you can work out, therefore, what the gravitational potentials are far from in a distant or far radiation zone. And they fall just like, because of the second order equation for this object, they fall like 1 over r, just given by the familiar form from the second order wave operator. And you can now look at the power radiated for a time harmonic source, go through the usual things you do in electrodynamics or in the linearized gravity theory. And if you construct the quadratic fluctuations in this in order to look at the stress tensor, that's gauge invariant also when you take spatial averages. And the result is you can compute the power radiated in scalar gravitational waves for a time harmonic source like this. And of course, this can be compared to the Einstein quadrupole formula. But of course, whereas the Einstein quadrupole formula starts out with a quadrupole term because of the transverse trace-free nature of those waves, in this case, we're talking about scalars, so there's a monopole term, and the leading order monopole contribution is this. So you see, you have to have time variation, or you don't get anything. Omega has to be different than zero, and there's a nice compact formula in terms of an arbitrary localized source, whatever the anomaly coefficient is. Now we can go look at different possible sources that might be around and ask how big an effect this is. Is this something that, for example, could be measured at LIGO?
So this A is local, right? It only has support in a compact region.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Let's assume that. Because I solved the wave equation under the assumption that there were no sources. Now I'm saying, suppose there's a localized source in some region, how big is the effect at a large distance?
The energy in these waves is coming both from gravity in second order terms and from
Yes. You have to expand up to second order and do appropriate averaging, and it's actually a little bit tricky to make sure that everything comes out right, to expand it consistently. And, you know, there's this trick, what is it called, Brill? It's just an Hartle averaging, that if you just look at local terms, they're not gauge invariant, but if you take a suitable average, they are, and you can. So it's just like gravitational waves. All right, so here's the anomaly terms. Well, you can quickly convince yourself that these higher order curvature invariants are going to be very, very tiny in any realistic environment, just because those are, you know, if the sources are ordinary matter, which are generating those curvatures for you, then these are going to be Planck scale suppressed just by the Einstein equation. So these terms are small in all but the most extreme, say, early universe Planckian-like environments. So you can drop all of these terms. And you can then ask about the matter contributions in realistic environments. So the first thing to look at is electromagnetism. We know last week I went over the conformal anomaly in a background gauge field. So it has this form, a first-order perturbation theory. So the strongest fields you could imagine are, for example, in magnetars, 10 to the 15 Gauss. It's enormous. So you put that in, and you get an energy density that looks like this. And now you compute that integral over some region, say, you know, characteristic of a magnetar magnetic field extent or a neutron star plus region outside, and you get something that looks that goes like 10 to the minus 26, even if this object is a kiloparsec away. So at more realistic distances in the galaxy or extragalactic sources, this is going to be very, very small and too small to see by LIGO or any of its next generation successors. Okay, so also, obviously, there's no effects at all in the solar system or direct terrestrial tests. So, you know, it's good and bad. It's good because it passes all observational tests. It's bad because it's hard to observe. So let's go now to the QCD, which you were asking about, and put in some typical values there. This is what the trace anomaly looks like. This is the strong coupling constant now, number of colors and flavors. And if you put in typical values for the standard model, you get much larger number for the energy density in the QCD vacuum. This should be is probably present inside both neutrons and protons as a bad constant, and is very likely present in the center of neutron stars and dense nuclear matter as well. But this is just an order of magnitude estimate. So if you have this condensate of gluons inside a neutron star, and if nothing is changing, you remember because of this omega squared, if omega is zero, the static, you're not going to see anything. But if you crash two neutron stars together, or a neutron star and another compact object, then you are going to excite this condensate if it's there. And then this scalar gravitational wave mode would be excited. So the estimates are back of the envelope, basically, just by integrating this kind of energy density over a neutron star volume, free volume, and just to get a number out. And I also mentioned that if the gravistar hypothesis I talked about a few weeks ago also contains a condensate, it may also excite this. So let's see, did I leave out? Oh, sorry, I left out a slide here just putting these numbers in, but the result is, I remember, is about on the edge of, it was something like 10 to the minus 20 to 21, and for something like 10 megaparsecs. So this is actually close to what LIGO might be able to see. You don't need the light, do you? Oh, you can't see it. OK. I'm sorry, I forgot. That slide got left out for some reason, but I'll dig it up. Anyway, you can just do it from here. This is roughly 10 times bigger than this. And therefore, you get something that's of order 10 to the minus 16 at a kiloparsec. But if you go much farther out, you get something that's close to the LIGO bounds. So this, of course, is nothing but a guesstimate. One would have to do a much more accurate calculation using nuclear equations of state, how much of a gluon condensate is present, or quark condensate also perhaps, and actually see how much is excited or heated up in a neutron star collision in order to estimate more accurately what the size of this effect would be. But it looks like it's very interesting. It could be possibly observable.
And distinguishable because it's a scalar.
And it's a breather mode. So it comes like this, which means it's now, in order to distinguish polarization states, you of course need more than one detector, or have a gamma ray coincidence signal, so you know where it's coming from. Then you know the projection onto your detector planes, and you'd have to reanalyze the data, because the way they're doing the analysis now, they're assuming only the standard one, the standard transverse polarizations, and then they've done a few tests just looking for, you know, more exotic polarizations like vector or scalar by themselves, and they rule those out. But if there's an admixture of scalar and ordinary tensor modes, it's a more complicated analysis to deconvolve it, and it's harder. One has to have.
I think they will look for that.
Is anyone?
Then it wouldn't match the expectations. I mean, if you're losing energy in a different channel, it won't be the case that you can, from one polarization on the other one, get consistency. Right? You should see some missing energy.
Well, it depends on how much that energy is, right?
Yeah, sure, they can.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but much more data is coming, right?
The detection, you shouldn't care about that.
No. Because you have two different detectors, they catch the polarization with a rotation, and you can see if the two results are consistent. And if there is some extra channel where you're losing energy, you see something missing.
You mean it won't fit? You mean it won't fit? It won't fit the yeah. So far in the events, they do fit,
yeah.
But
the error.
Right, yes. There is big, and we don't know. I don't know exactly how much is going to come out in this waves for the neutron star merger that was seen, for example. I mean, I can only estimate it. So this needs much more accurate a simulation, which hasn't been done.
I think wouldn't LIGO be very insensitive to a scalar mode, just because if you scale both arms together, then
Right. So
there's energy that is getting lost in a different channel.
No, you can also detect directly, right? Because unless it's coming straight on you, if it comes straight on orthogonal to your beam axis, then of course it's going to excite both arms the same way, and the difference is going to drop out. But if it's at any other angle, it's direction dependent, then the two arms are going to respond differently, and you will detect that in principle.
Right, but the two LIGOs are roughly aligned, I mean, by construction, so they need a variable.
As much more redundancy as possible to eliminate this effect, right? But if it came on, for example, the plane of the arms is like this, and the wave came in on this direction, then clearly it's going to move this and not this. So you will see it in the difference, right? That's the maximum effect.
So I have a question about the wave folds that are used to analyze the hypervertical
Yeah, we have to examine the equations. That's what Lewis and I
have been overly critical.
Yeah, no, be overly critical. It's fine. But I'm presenting it in order to have a discussion. It's more involved, but it's well defined. Okay. Yeah.
Isn't the scalar mode is not transverse to the line of sight? It's just.
It's a breather. Yes, it's transverse, but breathing in and out.
Yeah, so
yeah.
Along its direction.
Along its direction, it's oscillating.
But in the transverse itself.
If the wave is propagating like this, basically the waveform is oscillating. So it will change distances if it hits at that angle.
I'll have to look at it.
Yeah.
I think one also changes distances along the current propagation.
Yeah, that depends on the wave. That depends on the wavelength versus the size. Yeah. The effect you're talking about along the line of sight depends on the wavelength of the wave compared to the length of the arm.
Right. Here in the LIGO, it'll be the arm shorter than the wavelength.
Right.
I think it's similar.
Right.
Then it would be isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think LIGO doesn't put a very strong constraint on this.
No.
Except loss of energy.
Right. Right.
Binary pulsar data, very restricted from observation of these.
Yeah. But there's no effect on the binary pulsar, John, because this
has to be the version of it.
Yeah, because the source is the anomaly, and these terms are essentially zero in the binary pulse. Yeah, it's until things collide. Okay. All right. So that's one effect. So now I want to go back to the black hole case and then come to the sitter. So why should this be important in horizons? Well, because there's conformal symmetry near a horizon. The near horizon geometry, in fact, can be written as Euclidean anti de Sitter 3 cross time, and fields effectively become massless there. And I'll show you exactly how this works. It's well known to some people anyway. In that case, the conformal anomaly should become the dominant term in the effective action near horizon region. And we've tested this in a number of cases that we can actually calculate. The stress tensor is computed and is generally singular. So let's look at that. So here's the simplest case you can do it. This is the Schwarzschild background. So one thing you notice right away is that I can scale out this factor, 1 minus 2m over r, and write it as a conformal factor times something which has just the flat time and some non-trivial three-dimensional metric. And that's the kind of solution you're going to get for the phi field, because it's nothing else but a conformal rescaling of the metric in which phi is proportional to sigma, sigma e to the 2 sigma being the conformal factor. So you expect to get a solution which is log of f, where f is this metric function. Indeed, you do. That is a solution to the fourth order equation for the Schwarzschild background. And you can understand this physically from the conformal transformation. So it's a very big conformal transformation you're making, essentially near the horizon compared to the distant infinity. And quantum mechanics knows about that. So there's a killing field. The time component of the killing field is 1. And so this conformal factor is nothing else but the norm of the killing field, which is, of course, a curvature invariant. And so this quantity is actually a curvature invariant. It's non-local, but invariant. And you expect to get a big conformal factor, a big solutions of the phi equation, which are large. And so this gives a completely geometric coordinate invariant meaning to the non-local correlations on the horizon. Here's the general solution for static phi of r. It's not hard to solve that equation in terms of a few integration constants, which are CH, C infinity, and Q. So there's another constant if I integrated this one more time, but that's irrelevant. It drops out. So these are the three relevant integration constants. You could also add linear time dependence and still get a time-independent stress tensor. Now you notice what's going on here, just by looking at this form. The only way to have phi fall off at infinity is to set these two constants to zero. But the only way to have finiteness on the horizon is to set this constant to zero and this to a different value. Okay? So there is an obstruction, essentially, to having both finiteness on the horizon and nothing happening at infinity. And you see it sort of at a glance from this scalar conformalon equation of motion. If you wish, there are two conditions on three integration constants for horizon finiteness. So you can get a finite stress tensor on the horizon, but generically you won't if you choose any values of these constants that are different, even slightly different, infinitesimally different than those values. You'll get typically large effects on the horizon. And here's one test we could actually do. We chose these constants judiciously and tried to match what happens for the stress tensor. This is the radial component of the stress tensor in a particular state, which is called the Bulwer state. It was done directly by brute force numerical evaluation of the stress tensor for a scalar spin zero field. And that's, of course, a difficult calculation. You've got to separate the mode equation of the Klein-Gordon equation in the scalar field. You've got to introduce mode functions and corresponding Fock space operators. You've got to construct the expectation value of the stress tensor. You have to renormalize it, go through all that stuff. And Jensen et al. Did that in 1992, and they got these points from a numerical calculation. Page, Brown, and Ottewell tried to write down some WKB approximation, and they got this curve. Okay, our result is this solid curve. So you see two things. First of all, it gives the correct behavior on the horizon in this state, which is divergent. So for sure, it's a large macroscopic effect. This is the distance from 2m. And it does pretty well, but not exactly, for matching the numerical results. These are not, the line doesn't go right through these points, but this is not a bad qualitative behavior, and it matches it correctly at the horizon where the numerical results are run out of steam. It's hard to do it there. Okay, so that's an example of where you get slightly different finite results, but who cares if there's a big result going on here? So why is there conformal, why should this work? Why is there conformal behavior on the horizon? Many ways to look at it. If you look at the wave equation, and decompose in modes in the Schwarzschild coordinates, then you know there's a well-known radial mode equation in terms of the Wheeler coordinate R star, which looks like this. But the potential goes to zero because it's proportional to 1 minus 2m over r as I go toward the horizon. So this term just drops out, and near the horizon, all the masses, this is the mass of the field, just drops out. So everything becomes conformal there. Everything becomes equivalent. And if you do the step I said a few slides back and pull out f of r, then this spatial part is called the optical metric because it determines the null rays of the in that background. And you can show that this becomes, as you approach the horizon radius, this becomes just 3D Lobachevsky space. Nowadays, we call that Euclidean anti-de Sitter. Of course, Euclid didn't do it, nor was there anyone named anti-de Sitter. But this is Lobachevsky's first example of a non-Euclidean geometry. And so this is the traditional testing ground in which you can do all sorts of ADS, CFT kinds of matching, whereas you go to the horizon at z equals 0, z is proportional to the square root of this metric function f, which you remember is the norm of the Killing field. And basically, by looking at powers of z, you get the conformal weights of fields as they go to the horizon boundary. So that's why, that's a fundamental kinematic fact of why horizons have conformal behavior and why the stress tensor coming from the conformal anomaly should be relevant there. And we've tested in a number of cases. I won't go through them all here. Reisner-Nordström it works very well there too. So now let's go in the last part to cosmology and De Sitter space. Well, you can do the same. You can do the same thing. You can write down the metric. In fact, in this and solve the fourth order equation. In this case, nicely factorizes into two scalar wave operators, two second order wave operators. And there's a particular solution. Since this is non-zero now, this is coming from the Riemann tensor squared, which is non-zero in De Sitter space. And so there is a particular solution I call the Bunch-Davies, in which, again, this is just proportional to the conformal factor. If I take the a squared out, write it in conformal time, then write this as e to the 2 log a, then that's exactly what I expect to find for the Fife conformalon field, and that's equal to 2h tau in the Robertson-Walker time. Plug that into that stress tensor. I won't write it down, and lots of simplifications happen, and you in fact get just the Bunch-Davies De Sitter vacuum expectation value proportional to the anomaly coefficient, which has been known for many years. So this reproduces it very quickly. If you take any other solution, you're typically, again, going to get large effects on the horizon. And that's because TAB is divergent at the static horizon, behaving like 1 over f squared, which now f, well, I'll write it down in static coordinates in the next slide. So it basically has conformal weight 4, as you would expect for an energy momentum tensor. And that's going to generically produce these kinds of behaviors. But now let me linearize, since I did a linearization in flat space, let me do the same thing in De Sitter and look at what could be called scalar gravitational waves in De Sitter space. Well, this is quite an interesting story. What happens is there's a second factorization different from this one. This one is one way of factorizing the operator. There's a second factorization, which in the Robertson-Walker coordinates looks like this. And once again, if you impose the Einstein constraints, you find that only the solutions that have this thing on delta phi being non-zero contribute. So the only solutions that are relevant are the ones with this quantity I call u being different from zero, and they satisfy a second order equation. Again, at linear order around a completely different background, De Sitter this time, again, the equations become second order and the other mode decouples. If you write down the solutions to the linearized Einstein equations, the arithmetic's a little bit more complicated than in the flat space case, but not much. You can do it. And you find now an interesting story is that before we had only the sum of these potentials being non-zero and the difference being zero. Now they're both non-zero. So this mode basically becomes the box phi mode. You know, in flat space where h is zero and a is a constant, this just becomes box, right? And so this is just what I had before, the Mohs equation for the gravitational scalar potentials proportional to box phi. But now I get something new. I get also the difference of potentials satisfying this equation. Okay, this term will go to zero in flat space. So this means that there's a second, I mean, they're all generated by the same u, but this means there's a second gauge invariant combination of the potentials, which is non-zero in De Sitter. And you can easily solve this equation for u. It goes like this in the Robertson-Walker background. And you can then plug it in here and solve this equation also for the difference. And this goes this way. Okay. So this is, if you recognize it, is exactly the solution for a conformal scalar in De Sitter space, namely obeying this equation. So here's a second set of gravitational potentials, which are non-zero. And if I now look at these in static coordinates in De Sitter, it's very similar to the Schwarzschild story. And I find that they behave, all behave logarithmically, oscillating wildly on the horizon like this for any time dependence. Whereas if I look for a static solution, then this goes to zero, which means I get logarithms. And the logarithmic behavior is this. So I cannot avoid, if I have any solution at all, if u is different from zero, and I have any solution at all, which in the static coordinates is non-vanishing, then I'm generically going to get this kind of logarithmic behavior of the gravitational potentials on the horizon, which is a conformal weight zero field. The logarithm is weight zero. The power is formally zero. And this is quite interesting now, because this might actually have something to do with cosmology, in the sense that if I calculate the fluctuations of this field, because their conformal weight is zero, they're going to behave logarithmically on the two-sphere. And that means that the effective power, the CLs, which would appear in the scale of gravitational wave fluctuations, are going to be CL times L plus 1, our constant, which is just what you would expect, or just what you want, for a CMB power spectrum at large angular scales. So this actually comes out of this theory without any, it wasn't designed to do that, but it does. And the fluctuations in De Sitter space can now drive fluctuations in the scale of gravitational potentials with the same spectrum of the CMB ionosymmetry for large angles as inflation demands. I also don't have time to talk about, but if you have this conformal behavior on the horizon, then you also expect non-Gaussianity, and that non-Gaussianity can be computed by looking at the conformal Ward identities on the horizon, and it's quite different, again, from what you get in slow roll inflation. So this is still to be pursued. I'm going to run out of time. So let me just make a few other remarks. This is just a formal explanation of why you have this conformal invariance on the horizon. Basically, in De Sitter space, this decomposition, or rather this form, actually becomes exact. And this is the three-dimensional optical metric in the static frame becomes exactly Lobachevsky space, Euclidean anti-De Sitter. And so you can exactly carry out, in terms of the Killing vectors, you can exactly see what the conformal transformations on the horizon are. And basically, they reduce to the conformal group on the horizon is the Lorentz group realized projectively, including three rotations and three rigid special conformal transformation. So this is just some nice mathematics. You can go through it, but it basically explains why you have this conformal invariance on the horizon and how the De Sitter isometry group becomes on the horizon, has a subgroup, which is the conformal group of the horizon, and why you expect this logarithmic scaling of delta 4, which is the same thing as the Green's function of Laplacian on the two-sphere. It's a dimension zero field correlator, which must give a logarithm. OK, so I'm almost out of time. It's the third time. So I'm going to end here. Let's just try to summarize, and then we can have questions. So the linear variation, these are, if you wish, the form of scalar gravitational waves in De Sitter space. But they have new effects on cosmology because they diverge this way near the horizon. So, let's just state these things and then we'll quit. The linear variation of the stress tensor of the anomaly contributes. The relevant gauge invariant scale and mode satisfy second order wave equations at the linear order. So the types of ghosts that one gets in higher derivative theories at linear order even do not appear. Okay, the scalar field is a fundamental field, if you wish, from the anomaly, which is very different than an inflaton, but provides a scalar mode which can couple to the scalar gravitational potentials. So it's a new degree of freedom which should be considered in cosmology. In static De Sitter coordinates, the modes grow large on the horizon, corresponding stress tensor diverges, and suggests that there would be some interesting inhomogeneous and time-dependent effects also associated with these fluctuations. The fact that you get the correct log scaling for a Harrison-Zildjian spectrum can generate this from CMB without an inflaton. If we don't manage to find an inflaton, this would be a completely different mechanism. Of course, I haven't told you how you get out of the sitter space. You have to do, there's no slow roll here, so you have to do some different dynamics, a real dynamical evolution with the time-dependent Einstein equations coupled to this source. By the way, we also, years ago, also looked at fluctuations in the metric, and this leads to this picture that the cosmological term itself is not a constant, but is basically a low-energy constant, which can become dynamical and fluctuate through the fluctuations of sigma, and basically a picture in which lambda is a state-dependent condensate generated by a spontaneous symmetry breaking of global conformal invariants, and one can study the quantum phase transition in this conformally invariant phase. In other words, these fluctuations, which become large on the horizon, generate conformal correlators on the entire horizon, whether it's a Schwarzschild or a de Sitter horizon, and these effects can actually generate a conformally invariant phase there, which is a new effect that needs to be incorporated into the whole dynamics of either black holes or cosmology. So I'm going to end. Yeah, this we showed that if you do this in ordinary flat space that and put a lambda term in as a marginal deformation, it can generate a conformal phase where the running where lambda runs to zero by the fluctuations of phi. So this is a summary. I don't know if I'm going to read it all, but there is quantum corrections from the trace anomaly, and it does have effects that one can possibly observe in scalar gravitational waves, in black hole physics, anywhere there are horizons, including also in cosmology. Otherwise, the effects are very tiny and would easily have escaped notice up until now. This is derivable essentially from standard model physics and curved space. It's quite different from Brans-Dickey, does not couple to classical matter directly. And there's a lot to do here to get to apply this ideas to all kinds of other situations, like neutron star mergers, which has only been estimated. But we need a dynamical evolution, as you said, in order to do that. The only free parameters here are these anomaly coefficients B and B prime, which you can take from the standard model, or you can assume them to be free. There are scalar gravitational waves coming from this theory. These are likely, most likely to be excited in neutron star mergers. I already said this about horizons, scalar mode in cosmology without an inflaton, and possibly space-time dependent or spatially inhomogeneous cosmological models are suggested. And this has scarcely been touched up until now. And we really need to be able to evolve these equations dynamically, which is going to require a numerical study before we can make any more statements. But I hope I've convinced you that there's enough interesting stuff here that it might be worth doing. So I'm going to stop. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Yeah, we're out of time.
So. We're out of time. Yeah.
Questions for over lunch.
Okay.
And move on to the next speaker.
Okay. Okay.
Can I use the tablet?
Yeah.
You also want that now?
I want also to.
Before part two, we have a visitor from
Max Planck Institute from Germany.
Well, so many of them, right?
Yeah. For us, classical physics and copying nearby music.
Do you need help setting it up, or you're against?
Do you want this?
No, I was pleasure. I mean, I have just two slides. So.
Two slides, okay.
Yeah, I do it on my watch, the most thing.
Okay.
So, switching now completely the topic from theoretical physics now to more modeling of an observation is one of my projects working with Jerry together and also Akilia Devin, who's also a visitor here to, at the moment, and Julia Kirby and Alessandro it was my master's thesis, and there we looked at the one specific observation that caused the Kaushal to get the inner dark matter distribution of inside the Einstein ring.
Only by this lens.
And in principle, we could have also several more deflectors here, but that's not the situation we have in my observation, and that's the observation, the cosmic posture. You see a nearly full Einstein ring, the separation. So the Einstein radiuses are around 5 arc seconds, so it's very large, corresponding to a very, very massive galaxy here in the center. And additionally, we have now here a radial arc corresponding to this counter image. So you see here the radial arc in a zoom in combo, and here just in one HST band. And that's very special, very unique, this observation. And we want to see how much help us this radial arc to constrain the inner dark matter distribution inside the Einstein ring. Because normally we have only lensing observations on the Einstein ring itself, and here we have also inside the ring some information. And using then also the kinematics of this observation, we have also some additional constraints inside the Einstein ring. This observation was discovered by Belokurov et al. In 2007. As I said, it's the most, or it's very massive, it's the most massive galaxy ever observed. And yes, so we want to get a model of the mass distribution inside the Einstein ring. We started first with a total mass model where we do not distinguish between baryonic component and dark matter component. Here we assume just a singular power law profile plus external shear. For this, we used image identification on the Einstein ring for 3 sets, and also the radial arc and its counter image. Then, to disentangle baryonic component and dark matter component, we will model the light distribution of the galaxy, of the lens galaxy, so that we then have the baryonic component. And here we assume so the intensity versus the radius. We need 3 different or 3 components to model the light, simply because it's a very massive and complex galaxy. And try to sketch it here. We have one very peaky one component, one very flat component, and some component in between. These 3 components are then scaled by a master light ratio to get the baryonic component. For the dark matter, we adopt different profiles. The standard Navarro-Frankel white profile, a generalization of this profile, and again a power law profile.
What is the standard one? How does it work?
I mean, I don't know how this is the NFW profile. So that's the NFW profile, my standard NFW profile, and that's then the generalized version that we have here now an exponent.
Okay, these two components describe now the lens galaxy here in the center, which is like the light from the back of the background source for the Einstein ring, and the light from the source for the radial arc. And we need now, as I've said, also take this into account, the mass of the radial arc mass. Since the light from here for the Einstein ring is also deflected by this mass. Here we first model only on the image identification and then include the, or use the four observations as I've shown here on the slide, but in different filters of the Hubble Space Telescope. So the 160 filter, since we see there the light distribution very good, and then also the 475 filter, because there we see the radial arc, you see it here, and the Einstein ring much better. We have to model them differently, so because they lie on a different redshift.
I didn't think any questions. How does the radial arc arise? How do you get a radial arc? I can't really understand how Einstein is bringing it around.
So it's simply from the where the mass is located, so the galaxy, how it's stretched down.
So when your mass distribution is very cold and not so cuspy, you can have basically these high magnification regions, okay, at locations of these so-called critical curves where you have high magnification. So these big Einstein ring is the tangential critical curve, and when your mass distribution is not so peaky, then you can also have a radial critical curve near the center of the galaxy, and that's where you have radial arcs coming. Most of the time, in individual galaxies, you have most, like a lot of baryons, and it's very cuspy. You don't, the radial critical curve is very tiny, and you don't see it. But in this case, it looks, because it's such a big scale, group scale, it looks like the dark matter of the mass distribution is more cored, and then you can actually see the radial arc.
I see the radial arc is actually physically at a radius comparable to the size of the core, or maybe
so yeah, it's in this case about 1 arcsecond, so like about a few kiloparsecs comparable to the effective radius of the galaxy. Most of the time it's much smaller. And in the radial, so there's two critical curves. The outer critical curve that's tangential, so things are magnified tangentially, and that's what we see in the typical Einstein ring. And then the inner parts is the radial curve, and things are magnified radially, and that's why we see the radial.
Okay, how big is the dark matter contribution in the core?
That makes it wrong. So
the core of the count, how much is dark matter contributing? Say around less than 3 kilograms. Tissue curve goes up like that.
So in the center of the galaxy, in the central few kiloparsecs, what percentage of the mass would be in dark matter?
Okay, so percentage. It's up to one effective radii, it's around 60 to 70% dark matter. It's a bit high, yes, but it's a very massive galaxy, and this value is also matching to the value from Spinella et al. 2011.
Isn't this is going to cause cusp problems.
So we will see that we have at first difficulties to fit the NFW profile because it's
so stiff
in the center.
So what does this mean? Who's correct?
First, we assume now both or three different and profiles for dark matter, and later we will see which we can fit really and which not. And I think then I will hopefully answer a bit more the question. So, okay, as I've said, we started with the image identification, then include the full image. So, extended source modeling. And here we also include then the source surface brightness reconstruction of the two sources. And this model we use then to refine our image positions. Which one then to use to really model the observation. Here we include then also the kinematics coming from Spinera et al. Paper. They are ohms and data points, so we do not expect that high contribution, and that's also a reason why we use the image positions and not the full observation, because otherwise we would simply overwhelm the 7 data points. Here we also model only with the kinematic data, so dynamics only, and then also combine, as I've said, dynamics and dynamics. Again, we model with radial arc and without radial arc to see then the difference coming from the radial arc. In principle, we can fit the kinematics very good. That's mostly due to just since we have just 7 data points with relatively high uncertainties. So, and here we assume only NFW profile and polar profile for dark matter distribution, because on the based on our analysis on lensing only, we got no really improvement from the generalized NFW profile. Then first we assumed, as I've said, the light distribution scaled by mass to light ratio for the bionic component. And here we assumed a constant mass to light ratio. So 1 m over L for all 3 different components. Yeah, so therefore I sketched the 3 different components here that you see how they are look roughly like, and at first we scale all 3 with the same M over L. And here we saw, okay, we cannot really fit with the NFW profile just from chi-square. The polar profile is much preferred, but if we use the polar profile, we can, from chi-square, fit relative good to the observation, but then we are highly dark matter dominated. And therefore we thought about other possibilities and tried then to use different mass-to-light ratios for the different components. And here we saw that the very peaky central component needs a relative low mass-to-light ratio. And this could be due to coming more from an active region in the galaxy and not directly just from bionic mass, because it's so peaky the width of this component is smaller than the PSF width.
When you fit galaxies, actually the core, the structure, you need to polish the disk parts and the spiral, which are mainly dominated by the spin of material. So these models have to come in addition to the dot networks.
Yeah, so.
Do you have these models? The disk models, the explanation of this, which is thin.
Okay, so we just have now the lens light modeled and use this then as the bionic component.
It is fitting to the light distribution
so,
of the lens that you see in the center with these three components. And with like Sirsich-like profiles, so conventional this light and some would be altered. But it's an early type galaxy, so there's not much of a disky component.
It's not a spiral galaxy.
This lens is not a spiral.
It's a
massive early type, massive
okay.
Elliptical galaxy.
And what about the bulb? It doesn't have a disk like bulb.
No, it's not.
It doesn't have
an elliptical.
It's an elliptical galaxy.
It's an elliptical galaxy.
Yeah, so there is an elliptical galaxy, but it's very massive. So when we try to fit a single, like the globular, it doesn't fit very well to that light distribution. So we needed to add more components. So in the end, Stefan needed three to provide a decent fit to the light distribution.
So for elliptical galaxies, you have to work out the dispersion velocity because stars are just moving around.
This is just the light, and then we do a dynamical modeling to infer the velocity distribution based on the mass. That's right. Yeah. So, but right now he's just focusing on the light distribution of the galaxy because then he can use that to estimate the baryonic mass,
yes.
Given assumed mass light ratios.
Okay. So. Based on this, the multiple mass light ratios, we saw that the central component needs a very or relative low mass light ratio. And there we came up with the idea if this central component could be from active region in this very massive galaxy. And therefore, we assumed now not this central component, the very peaky one in the center. Instead, for the light, we have this field, but for the mass, we assume now a point mass simply in the center, because that's then of the width of the PSF from parity to the field we've got from the light. And using now the point mass in the center of the galaxy and two other light components, we are able to fit the observation relative good with both profiles for the dark matter. So NFW and all seem to fit to the data. The dark matter fraction is now in a good region. With around 60%, and also the mass light ratios for the two other components from the light seem to be physically meaningful. So that's now our final model, very same. This would describe the observation with the radio arc, which you included now. So in total, we saw that we are able to fit to such a complex strong lens observation, also including the radial arc, and we saw also that the radial arc helped us to constrain the profile of the matter. Yeah. So that's hopefully our relative finish project. Started. Okay.
Thank you.
Two parameters from the study of two parallel.
Well, it's
forward.
So for the dark matter component, or?
Less alpha, W power.
Yeah, we have either for the dark. We have assume for the dark matter component either a N of W profile or the power law profile. Assuming constant mass light ratio, yes. But at the end, when we see we need different mass light ratios or this point mass, then it's relative comparable. So the chi square is very similar. And in principle, we have a lot of other parameters in the model coming from the bionic component, coming from the external shear, and so on and so forth. So it's not just four parameters at the end. So
it's a total order.
Yeah.
Start fitting 20 galaxies, a lot of galaxies. You have four or five parameters each. You're getting a huge number of planets.
Yes, so, but this is now just one single galaxy, the lens.
Yeah.
But we need several or three components to filter the observation with such simple profiles.
So, do you have a measure of the dispersion velocity?
So that's the kinematic data. This is what we then include also, yes. But as I've said, that's seven measurements, so seven data points, and therefore not contributing that much.
Because the start has been a problem fitting the start of the process elliptical count, especially when we're under severe stimulations. They don't come out correctly. These are larger CDM simulations.
Okay.
So in this image, it looks as though you've got two tangential arcs. So there's an upper arc, and can you explain why particularly the overlap area, why we would have these two distinct arcs?
So we can get only in theory the full Einstein ring. And therefore, it's normally always splitted. If we have here the lens, then either like we now have here the more fine part or the lengthy part of the Einstein ring, and here the opposite part. Exactly. And, this is, I think, just because the background galaxy, the source, is stretched, so not a single point source, and therefore some parts are more longer or shorter, and therefore it's slightly overlapped.
Okay, so these are different parts of the galaxy, they're just on the right. You've got two overlapping rings at different radius, and just seem, so you're saying that would be imaging of different parts of the galaxy, or is that due to the intermediates, the second lens?
I think it's more from the galaxy bareform to the source. So because the deflection of the light should be done for all parts similar. So
the upper arc and the lower arc are the same, they're the lensing of the same source.
Yes. So the four ring part is coming from one galaxy.
Imagine the source has two clumps. This is a star forming galaxy, so it's very clumpy. So there's like two main clumps. One gives you this and then the other clumps give you this other side arc. And they're displaced on the source plane. So also when you lens it, they're displaced in terms of the offset.
Okay, so because it's not like an elliptical,
exactly.
It's actually a
star-forming clumpy galaxy.
So
and the source that's being analyzed.
What distance are the source and lines at? What distance are the source and lines at?
The lens is at point at 0.4 redshift. The radial arc is around redshift 2, and the Einstein ring source is around 2.4. Yeah, so here you see our image identification, which are mapping then the points to the corresponding points.
Let's thank your speaker.